Good morning, good morning, good morning. Welcome back to the Universal Love Movement podcast show. I really do appreciate you all for joining us on this special series on accessing ability. This is part two. This is actually part three, and I'm going to be joined by Professor Waters, who is an expert on artificial intelligence, machine learning, neurodiversity. And I just really want to thank you, Professor Waters, for joining me today. We're really excited about diving deep into the myriad of abilities waiting to be accessed for us all. As I mentioned, I'm your host, Dr. Carl S. Moore, and this is the third episode in our special kickoff series for accessing ability under the Universal Love Movement podcast. Professor Waters, good morning, and thank you for joining me today. How are you today?
Good morning. Thanks for having me. I'm doing very well. I hope you're well as well.
Yeah, doing very well. I'm really excited to dig into this topic because, as you know from our conversations before, you really are at the nexus of when we're thinking about neurodiversity, when we're thinking about our capabilities, when we're thinking about what people's capacities are. I just wanted to really hear about, you know, let the listeners hear about your background and how you started on this journey. And you know, with AI, you were interested in AI before it was the most buzzing hot topic. So that'd be really cool to know about that as well. But just give us a little bit about your background.
So my background is really interdisciplinary, which lends itself very well to a technology that undergirds just about every corner of our society at this point. And so I came into artificial intelligence not as a computer scientist, but more on that cognitive science, psychological side of things. And I was able to see that there are a lot of overlaps between the way you train an AI and the way you might train a person in certain ways. So there's overlaps between classical conditioning and operant conditioning in psychology with reinforcement learning and the different kinds of training models that there are in artificial intelligence. And when I started to appreciate those, I started looking at how sometimes the AI, when it's being trained in the initial phases, behaves like people that have been labeled with having a presentation of some kind of neurodiversity, and that sometimes it takes things very literally. It sometimes can't make certain associations, and how you have to train that to be kind of refined into the way that you're looking for. And that relationship for me between sort of that human neurobiological analog and the actual intelligent system was really attractive. And so I started looking at how we can understand each other, because some of the things that present in AI are similar to the things that present in human beings.
Very true.
And so it's not a one way, I need to have AI that behaves like a person. It's okay, this AI has hints of what we've seen in people. This is what I need to do to train it out of a person. Is it the same as what I need to do to train it out of a system? And vice versa, this is how I train it out of an AI system. Are there overlaps between that and how I deal with it on the human side? So that led to some very interesting conversations about bias in particular. Okay. And how both can have you have human cognitive debiasing as a technique. It's a psychological intervention.
Okay.
But I'm working on the digital cognitive debiasing in one of my research projects. And it's been a very interesting process showing like each of these systems side by side and the steps you have to go through. So as I was doing that, concurrently, I was looking at how people who have diagnoses of some kind of neurodiversity are navigating the world, and how these systems can be used as an assistive technology. Mm-hmm. And we've already seen examples of this when you think about, you know, screen readers for people who have vision impairments,
yep,
speech recognition, all kinds of text-to-speech tools, especially helpful for people who have trouble sometimes reading and understanding what they read versus when they hear it, they can understand it much better. There are all kinds of technologies that assist with mobility and things of that nature. They can be enhanced by AI support. And so I wanted to look at how we can make that more robust. We always see how AI is this creative, you know, conduit for people, and how we can make all kinds of performance enhancements using the technology. And I want to put that same energy behind how we can do that with creating assistive technology that is actually individualized and meaningful, and as well as at the same time, how can we look at these systems and use the strengths that they have to identify and mitigate bias? So I'm on two different ends of the spectrum a little with my personal research, but I feel that they're still complementary because there are sometimes questions that aren't being asked, or there are questions that might be challenging to answer. And so I'm a firm believer, as many people have probably heard me say, on the neurodiversity end, that everyone is not neurotypical. There's no typical in that everyone processes in their own way. Everyone has their own approach to how they navigate the world and see the world. And technology is really good now in terms of AI and recognizing patterns. And you may feel as an individual that you just don't have enough data to train an AI on your habits, but you've been doing it already. It's your phone will suggest as soon as you get in the car, a lot of days, the fastest route for you to get to work. It may know that on Saturdays you like to go to a certain location. It may suggest the fastest route to that. You have recommendation systems through Netflix and on social media that are continuously suggesting things based on the patterns that you have displayed over time. AI can be that granular, and we can just imagine if it was that granular for the benefit of supporting how you interpret the world in a way that's accessible to you. So if it's, you know, your nonverbal, how can AI be leveraged to allow you the communication on the level that feels robust for you? If you are not able to speak or not able to hear, and you use sign language, how can AI be leveraged so that you don't have to change anything about what you're doing, but it allows other people to now understand and be able to communicate back with you, even if they don't have this language ability?
And that
my approach isn't that people who have neurodiversity need to be fixed. My approach is that people who have neurodiversity need the supports of the technology so that they can live, but now we can live alongside them without, you know, we need to speak their language. We need to understand their process. We need the translator. They don't need the intervention of being fixed.
And like you said before,
so that's a long story for how I started on this journey and why I stay on it. We all know that bias is an issue. We need to address it. It's always often said to be intractable, because the bias is in the data. It's baked in. It's one of those things where a lot of people just throw their hands up and say, you know, you're never going to be able to remove this. But AI is really, really powerful at finding these kinds of patterns, and we need to leverage its strength against itself in a way.
Against itself.
So that we can do a better job at answering that question and preventing it at the outset and looking at the data sets that we're using so that they are pre-processed appropriately. We're using the right fairness metrics. We're using the right transparency information. there are lots of elements that go into that, but I'm gonna stop because I've been holding the floor for quite
no
a bit
it's great. It's there's so much connection, and it's like, you know, join me for the entire thing to co-host, because this is exactly, you know, I wrote a blog for OLC back in, like, I think it was 2019. It was accessing ability through digital means, and that's how this started. And everything that you mentioned there, which, you know, I'm fortunate that we know each other now, you've done the research for me, it was just a divine inspiration in terms of, you know what, I, for my dissertation, Professor Waters, I used, Dragon Dictation. I also used my screen reader, and I've been using the accessibility features on my iPhone since it, and that's one of the reasons why I switched over from Android, because I could activate it. Now, I know talk to text and reading, you know, text to speech is a little bit more popular now, but everything you're saying, I'm just gonna pull out some pieces from what you had mentioned just now. I love this idea that all of us, you know, you mentioned that no one's, there's no such thing as, it's atypical. And we have an episode tomorrow, actually. It's, we are all on a spectrum. It's kind of like a play on words in a sense where, you know, good buddy Todd Zakrajsek, he's very famous in the teaching and learning world, but he's coming in to really dig deep into that and what that means and just have a conversation. What you mentioned today, It's such an alignment to that. And one of the pieces that I really love that I want to highlight for the listeners is this idea of AI making the world more personalized for you. You used the word robust, and you mentioned that a couple of times. And I really just love this existence of a more personalized world that recognizes your capacities and you know, I'm really, really excited about that. Excited about all these things, but I wanted to share with you kind of that I was picking up what you're putting out and just making sure that the folks are seeing themselves in it. Everything you're saying is relatable to everyone. And with your background and your expertise in AI, your expertise in neurodiversity, and your just, whether it be lived and then your, you know, your the acquired knowledge that you have from your research, how would you say that, you know, the machine learning part, if we dig back into that, I just wanted people to understand a little bit more. How does this really, what are the places in which you've figured that, okay, we have to learn more about how the brain works when we're talking about machine learning? Because, you know, machines, aren't they trained to learn like brains? And then you mentioned that, but I want to help folks understand that a little bit more. What are we still finding out about the brain that can really help this machine learning, but we're not there yet?
So, well, the caveat is that we're not there yet with our own brain. We are not masters of understanding
right, that's what this whole thing's
every
about.
Aspect of it. So that's the next frontier as well on both sides. So the more we understand about our brain, the more we can understand about cognition overall.
Okay.
The goal for, and we have a lot of understanding about cognition, metacognition, mm-hmm, all of that, mm-hmm, but the goal for people who are trying to create smarter AI is that they are trying to replicate that cognition in some way or another. And the one thing that is really, really analogous between AI and the human brain is plasticity.
The plasticity
occurs right. When the human brain creates new pathways and connections. And that happens in artificial neural networks. And that phenomenon has made AI that are plastic much more robust than those that aren't, and they are the higher performing neural networks. And so what we've done, because it's what we always do because we're humans, is that we like to make things that we can relate to that are like us. We hold ourselves as the standard, you know, whether that's a positive or a negative, that's a whole philosophical discussion that we could have. we hold ourselves as the gold standard of intelligence, of engineering, ingenuity, creativity, all of these kinds of things. And so we are making these systems sort of to pattern behind us. And that has brought its issues with it. But humanity is flawed. AI is flawed. It's patterned after our information, our thought processes. So it's never going to be perfect. It's like we're never going to be perfect. So it's a question of looking at what's analogous. So you're not going to have the equivalent of an amygdala in the artificial intelligence as you do in the brain, and it's responsible for some really instinctual, primitive, this is how our ancestors survived kind of reactions. But the AI can have things that are processes that you can introduce so that it can operate in that way or an approximation of that. The getting to that, it's a little tricky to say, this is how it's just like the brain, because we still don't know why certain things happen or don't happen in the brain. And not everyone is going to have a similar outcome if there's an event in the brain.
Yeah, so much variation.
Yeah, there's so much variation.
Well, then, going back to what you mentioned earlier, how is this this research and your expertise, how has this really reshaped or expanded your understanding of abilities in the modern era? You touched on it earlier. It's kind of, this accessing ability piece is, hey, let's open our minds, right? And everything that you're saying in terms of us not understanding the brain fully, of course, and then, there is this a new frontier. But yeah, how has that reshaped or expanded your understanding and those who your contemporaries of on ability?
So it's interesting, if you think, and I'm going to use a metaphor that sounds unrelated, if you think about when you're driving in traffic and you see someone has one of those bumper stickers that says something along the lines of rookie driver, new driver, things like that, like you might have had a really negative reaction to their speed. Like they might not have been going fast enough for you. They might not have used the blinker the way you thought they should have. But then you see that bumper sticker and you're like, oh, they're just starting out. And then there's empathy. There's a little more patience. And we extend that to artificial intelligence almost readily. Like it can be frustrating that it's not learning what you want, but you're like, oh, but you're just figuring it out. Basically it has that bumper sticker on it and it's implied. I'm a rookie, I'm learning. And I'm seeing that we're willing to extend that empathy and all of that to inanimate objects, or we need to see that bumper sticker for us to appreciate that we need to be a little more patient. And the AI process of researching and working with neurodiversity and analyzing it and studying it has shown me that people don't want to put that sticker on necessarily for themselves. Like they don't want to put that sticker on, like you need to be patient when you're working with everyone. You need to extend that empathy because you don't know who has a presentation or not upon your first interaction. And it's not something that people should have to constantly disclose for you to pull back and pump your brakes and go, okay, yeah, I'm really overreacting, or I'm not being inclusive of any other perspective except mine. And so training in AI, I'm kind of training that in. AI don't get frustrated or impatient. They just analyze and see patterns and go, okay, this is probably the outcome. People, on the other hand,
so much more.
Like, what's taking you so long? Why haven't you done so and so?
We have so much more going on.
Frustrated.
I love this.
Well, we have a lot going on, but AI has a whole, like, it could be doing trillions of processes in the background and it never gets frustrated.
Yeah, it doesn't get frustrated.
The AI doesn't have a bad day.
Yeah.
But, people, on the other hand, they're coming in with the negativity usually much more in place and entrenched. And you need a signpost to offload that negativity where you don't really need that an AI. So if I'm trying to train an AI to behave more like a regular person, it's not going to be friendly, you know? So
wow.
It's interesting how you see these things lined up next to each other.
Goodness.
And it's a dynamic that we have to account for. If your AI isn't friendly and it treats you like you treat other people, for instance,
goodness,
you wouldn't like it.
Yeah, the lack of grace, the judgment,
right. And so it's really
goodness.
But keep that in mind, because
right.
that's kind of what the data wants the AI to do. The mm-hmm. data sets that are used to train AI kind of come embedded with those kinds of biases and behaviors baked in. And so you have to pull all of that out so that your AI doesn't become some tyrant that is really prickly and
reductionist and judgy, and even though judgy's not a word.
Right. And so that was one of the more interesting things. I can approximate a lot of processes in a human, but if I keep the actual negative behaviors out,
goodness,
it's like, oh yeah, we like this thing. But if I keep the regular people, like if you train an AI on social media, oh my gosh, and I'm saying this from someone who has done that, it is not a nice AI at the end of it. We have examples of this on a very large scale with Microsoft's Tay, how it was allowed onto what was Twitter, and it was completely ruined. It didn't take 24 hours for it to become this hateful, racist, just completely spewing negativity, and they had to take it down.
And Professor Waters, that data, what they would be consuming and digesting is, because that's what's out there, right, in the social media. You know, it's interesting, people, when it comes to the, and this is something to discuss now maybe, but you know how they say drama sells, and you know that negativity sells, and then you know how our brains, how we're, you know, how we wire and then how we fire as it relates to just learning things. When it comes to what people are consuming, you see these negative hooks on different YouTube videos or things that are kind of promoting folks. And the question for you would be, do you feel as if, and this ties into this conversation, do you feel as if from your just lived experience, studies and expertise, people are drawn towards the negativity because of that ways their brains have been trained, or is it some natural inclination? Because if we were to flip things and we were socialized and wired to be, or programmed rather, to be more attracted to positive or more growth narratives, etc., that would be attractive. Could there be a reset? I remember when I was younger, it was like, yeah, they only promote like this negative hip hop, misogynistic, or like, you know, negative hip hop music because that's what the people want. And it's like, the people are trained to want. That's what I used to think. But, you know, talk to me a little bit about that in terms of your thoughts, in terms of what is human nature, because you really are digging into and there's so much of a undiscovered frontier of what human nature is as it relates to that negative element versus there being another side that we haven't been trained towards.
So a part of this we can already observe right now, and a lot of it is cultural.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
People from different cultures react to negativity in different ways. And if you see someone from, let's say, the Maori people who are really well known for their hakas and their tattoos and their culture and all of that, the word for autism in their language means in his or her own time.
Just different frame already there. Yeah.
So it's already setting you up for a different
experience. Yeah.
thought process based on the culture. And so some people may think of the Maori people and they see that haka before the football matches, or in the United States, the soccer matches, and they see those faces that they make and the noises and how loud it is and the tattoos in different places, and they assume and they appoint certain characteristics to that. But a culture that gives you a definition or word for autism that means in his or her own time is one that's showing a lot of empathy. And so in some cultures, that's the first reaction, is empathy. And in other cultures, it's the lack of empathy. And so we have these cultures right now that we can access and actually see.
They're programmed differently.
They are more acculturated to be empathetic, so that if they see something negative, it pains them. They don't want to see people suffer. Some of us in our culture have a little bit of this, and it's, you don't even want to see something where someone gets embarrassed.
It pains you to your human.
You feel the secondhand embarrassment because you can connect to that feeling and you have an empathetic reaction. Not everyone is wired that way. Not everyone is acculturated in that way. And so you have all of these various shades on the spectrum of humanity, because we were talking about living on the spectrum earlier. And where people are presenting themselves to you and to each other in all of the shades that make them a fully fledged person. And for some, the empathy dial has been turned up to the max. Some people, it's been turned down to the minimum. Some people are everywhere in between. And depending on what your culture deems acceptable, your dial has been adjusted. And in our culture, when you turn empathy way up, it's in our culture's mind, you've turned strength down. And so our culture feels that empathy is a weakness, and it tries to drive that down. Like, you gotta be number one. It's all about you. It doesn't matter what's happening to anyone else. We put our blinders on when we walk by, and we just focus on what puts ourselves individually out in front, or just our family out in front. And so for other communities where it's much more close-knit, and they've cultivated this idea that, you know, we all make it together and we're all connected by whatever it is, and that's a value statement, that kind of empathy is all they have ever known. And so consider Indigenous American populations, when they are raising children, they often punished children by dunking them in water. And so children behave a lot better in the winter than they do in the summer. And that's the culture that has happened. When it's hot outside, you can be as wild and as free as you want to be, but when it's cold, you're going to be really mindful and you're going to make good choices.
Or you're going to get that water.
Or we're going to be in that water. Culturally, that sends a message to how these communities work and how they interact with themselves and the rest of the world. Now, we're in modern times, so there's not always going to be water available in that way, but just consider what that does to your mind in terms of, all right, it's warm, it's time for me to run around and kick up dust and do all of these things, versus it's cold, I really need to pay attention, I need to focus on whatever it is. So seasonal behavior has been cultivated in that scenario. You know, there's always a lot of different ways we can look at these things, but it's just, it's interesting what cultural values influence and how you can be on the outskirts, even within your own community, based on how high or low your culture has decided to turn the dial on certain attributes that it deems most valuable.
Wow. That's such a huge, there's so many sound bites and takeaways. That's so huge. I'll repeat it again, how much the culture you're in, which you're being acculturated, in other words, programmed or socialized, what have you, into empathy. Or I love this image or this kind of like the dial in my mind. I can see it clearly turn up, like you said, or down, or not existing, just totally off, or somewhere in between. It just really touches me in a deep way, because if we were to, that is truly the spirit, at the core of the spirit of this work, you know, the Universal Love Movement. I figured sometimes that dial is like limited or impacted by people's ability to really love themselves, and it may not have been a thing. You can't have empathy for another if you don't have empathy for yourself, or to what degree. And what you're saying right now is so huge, and it's so necessary, because when machines are taking over more tasks, you know, our value is to be humans. And I love the clear picture about, you know, society and how it's really, everything's open to me in terms of conversation, but it really becomes irrefutable what you're saying as it relates to, no, we're just kind of programmed this way. Some cultures don't like when people hurt, and that doesn't mean that we have to just accept this deficit-based kind of negative loving drama type of reality. That can be really empowering for a lot of folks, Professor Water. So I really appreciate the way in which you said it and the way you dug into it. And just yesterday there was my colleague on the other episode, part two, who Dr. Laura Pipe, she was indigenous pedagogy. She really frequents in that. And the relationship to the earth, that's an entirely different level of empathy she was talking about in terms of what her grandmother used to ask her, in terms of like, hey, what did you learn from the sky today? What did you learn? And I was thinking to myself when you were just speaking right just now, how often do we ask ourselves, what do we learn from like a heart space with other people? So there's a lot here. And when it comes to your understanding of where we are right now, if you're as an educator, right, and then also as a professional, how do you think we could leverage technology, but then also leverage this fusion between that kind of hard and soft, right, like the hardware of whether it be, well, maybe that is software. Would you call AI software or hardware? I'm not sure what you would call it. How do you think we leverage that with our sense of being? How do we balance that? Our sense of humanity. If we were to grow both in your ideal world, how would we grow them both together to where we have this like more progressive existence for ourselves?
I think you have to start to acknowledge, as I was talking about earlier, that both of us and the artificial intelligence and all people are flawed. AI is never going to be perfect.
Yeah.
And so for me, in the most ideal scenario, humans and AI are working together to enhance each other's blind spots.
Enhance blind spots. Okay. Okay.
So we acknowledge that AI is not the panacea for everything. AI isn't super intelligent. We can give it tasks and train it to do those tasks with efficiency and do them very well. But anything beyond those tasks are typically like, it's like they have no idea what it is. We're still in artificial narrow intelligence for the most part, and we're moving close to artificial general intelligence. For those who've not heard these terms, artificial narrow intelligences are really good at performing a specific task. So think about an AI that's been trained to play chess. Think about an AI that has been trained to, I don't know, let's say if it was just doing translations of languages. It's really good at a specific task, where general AI is really good at multiple tasks. And some people may say, well, we have self-driving cars, that's AGI, but they're not really good at multiple tasks because they are still hitting people. They are still, you know, doing
unfortunately,
things that are outside of what they should be doing. So they're not really good at it at this time, but they should be able to handle multiple things at once. And these multiple things, you know, you can get kind of free with the definition of what that actually means. So we have to look at, for the most ideal, while we are in this phase of development, how can humans be enhanced in their abilities with artificial intelligence in a way that if the AI was not there, their enhancement wouldn't be as robust. And then the reverse, how can humans enhance AI so that if the human was not there, the AI's performance wouldn't be as robust? That's the most ideal scenario for me, because you're understanding that we are both flawed as systems and as individual species, members of the human race. And if you can acknowledge that and accept that the AI isn't going to be the answer to everything, and you can't just offload 90% of what you don't want to do onto it, and that it's a tool, it's like a human was really good at planting food, but then they made tools to help with that. So then you had like a pickaxe, and you had a shovel, and you had all these things. So the human can still grow food, but its ability to do that is enhanced by these tools that we've developed. That's what AI is. AI is a new pickaxe. It's a new shovel. It's a new combine.
Yeah.
It's a new solar panel powered system. You know, so as we've evolved, our tools have evolved alongside us, and AI is just another tool. But it's the same with that kind of development of a tool, in that every time we create a tool, it's for the changing of our environment. And so there's a responsibility piece that we have there to look at how we're changing our environment in the presence of this tool. So AI absolutely has an impact on environment, because the training that has to take place, the amount of energy that consumes, how that energy is generated, what materials are needed to create the systems that allow for these faculties to be present in the first place, all of these things have an impact and a cost to the environment, just like the pickaxe meant a tree had to be cut down. So we have to look at this in totality, just like we look at ourselves and we look at these systems. We're still on this planet, so we have to look at that as well and make sure that the cost benefit analysis is actually performed and not assumed.
That's powerful, and you've and from what you had mentioned earlier, being more on the empathy side, right, you know, and being more humanized and inclusive in that. Because if we are not there, what I'm, you know, learning and getting from this, if we're not there, it's going to impact how we use the tools, or even our ability to perceive how we use the tools. And what recommendations would you say specific would you have for for professionals, like in whether it's leadership space, educators in the classroom, and then even policymakers as it relates to these. And you don't have to touch on all groups if you don't, considering what you had mentioned just now.
Well, it's the same for everyone. You want to become familiar with how these systems work on the baseline level. You don't have to be an expert, but you have to understand, for instance, large language models, and we only hear about those right now because the innovation is so massive right now in that space. You have to learn the language of prompt generation in order to get the best out of these things.
Okay.
So for all of these technologies, you have to expose yourself to them and understand the basics. So prompt generation can be as complicated or as easy as you decide it has to be for your particular use case. But you, as a professional, as an educator, whatever you're doing, to maximize the use of that system has to understand a little bit of the basics about how you prompt it to get information out. Our research, AI research architect and I at the center talk about prompt generation all the time because we're Trekkies. And if you look at any Star Trek episodes, what the crew does with the computer is prompt generation. They say, computer, extrapolate such and such and so and so. Computer, put these two parameters together and make a map of the system. Computer. And they give the parameters and the guardrails, and then the computer gives them something. Yep. The computer doesn't just volunteer information throughout the episode. Yeah. Someone has to ask it questions. Someone has to do something. So in this example, everyone on the ship knows how to talk to the computer. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. No matter what their job is, the people who babysit the kids all the way up to the chief engineer, they all speak to the computer in prompt generation. And so that's where we have to get to the comfort level of just understanding the basics enough. You know, the person in childcare might not need to know quantum mechanics of communication, but if they were interested in it, they could ask the computer. And so you have to have that kind of familiarity. And some people might say, oh my gosh, you know, that's a whole other skill we have to learn and all of this. But in my lifetime, Google was created. Yep. So I went to school in a time where keyboarding was done on a Smith Corona. So in my lifetime, I've seen that people were capable of asking the computer questions.
Yeah, and becoming better researchers, web researchers, or, you know, on leveraging Google. Yeah, 100%.
Yeah, and so, you know, we had the Dewey Decimal System in the card catalog in the library. That doesn't happen anymore. And so you're capable of learning these different kinds of systems as they evolve. You just have to expose yourself to them and get the really, really basic knowledge. So whatever it is in whatever industry, it doesn't have to be an LLM. It's just an example that most people resonate with because of how it's been prominent in this news cycle for the last year. It's all you hear about. But all of these technologies are similar. You've been interacting with something like Alexa, Siri, Google. You might have a robot that vacuums your floors. You might have a smart refrigerator that's telling you when you're low on things. You know, all of these systems are underpinned by this technology, and you've been interacting with them without realizing it. So now if you just put a little bit of intention behind it, then you can start to leverage it as a tool. But then you might also start to see where it has blind spots and be a part of the conversation on fixing them. But you can't do that if you don't actually expose yourself to them.
Wow, that's so, it's so the, it's the spirit and core of what we're trying to do here with the, you know, the podcast series and accessing ability. It's like, be intentional. You are capable. You know, that asset-based lens, as you know, it's not something that is widespread. You know, we're still working, you know, the whole work on mindset, but there, growth mindset, Dweck's work, and but there is a, that's just part of the picture. There's this understanding, and then there's this doing that you're really blending in here. And the familiarity that people have to have with the tools to even know what to do. What you had mentioned a moment ago, I'm thinking the word curiosity came up when it comes to prompt engineering, where it's like the more curious, it seems as if, and I would love to hear thoughts on this, but it seems as if when we're educated, you know, the education towards being like truly curious versus definitive, it seems like sometimes they're kind of like, they're not always opposing, but they're kind of opposing. Whereas for me, research it, you know, it's like, okay, I have this, I'm really curious about this, and I'm going to form a hypothesis, and I'm not going to be so deterministic even after I, you know, conduct my research to say, hey, I know everything about everything. I think there's some folks that, whether it be a researcher or a person on their learning, that may have come to conclusions beforehand on their learning or about what they're going to find or not find. And one of my favorite quotes is, what is it? I forget who says this. I think it was Young. Said the answers you get depend largely on the questions you ask. And that really, what you had mentioned about AI reminds me of that, you know, in terms of what you're going to get, the output. And I think you taught me this way back when we were talking about this, like last December or something, I don't know, where it's like the output versus the input. So that prerequisite, I don't know if that's the space that you're in with dealing with the prerequisite states of being in terms of people needing to do whatever healing work or just like rewiring up their brain, or whether, I know that you're big into meditation and kind of helping your brain become healthier to do these things. So I know that was a yarn ball of things, but when it comes to that being capable element and what we need to do to see ourselves as capable is a huge piece for me.
Well, and that's interesting because it depends on what pair of glasses you have on.
There we go.
You see capability and how you perceive it. And so you could be talking to someone who feels that they are fully capable in this particular area, and then another person is looking right at them going, no you're not
right.
And yeah, we just have so much of that right now in our society where it's, you know, and it's never in the middle, it's always extreme.
Like
the pendulum swings in one direction or the other. So it's, a lot of this is up for interpretation, and we aren't taking a lot of time to have the dialogue where we try to agree on what the framework is or what the thing is. Everyone's kind of defining it for themselves, and then they're shutting their ears and their eyes, and they're just saying, you know, this is my particular worldview, and this is what it is as far as I'm concerned, and mine is the only one that matters. And that's it. So the turtle goes right into the shell, and it won't come out.
Yeah, that part,
so
right,
it's
there.
It's interesting where we are.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, when you had mentioned earlier about the environment, and I know we're going to close out soon, but I just have to, you know, double click on this. When you were, that piece about the car, and then you look at the bumper sticker and you're like, oh, okay, and how we don't, that's such a huge takeaway with all of this in terms of the grace, going back to that grace that we can give each other, you know, and the grace we can give ourselves, and then getting into being like, okay, because that shuts your brain down, of course, as you know, in terms of what else could be happening. So I just want to go back to that. But yeah, where we are is pretty interesting, and there's I'm big into growth narratives. I have like this positive view on the future. At minimum is a 50-50. This is what I tell people. I'm like, at minimum, there's a 50% chance it could slant towards positive. So I don't, you know, the deterministic views about where we're even going, some of that is, it's not, what's real is the present right now, right? And we could use, as you mentioned about the tools, we can use this to create an entirely amazing world where everyone has abilities to do, or it could be like the whole singularity kind of Terminator thing. But I don't hear as much conversations about the world of, you know, where we're having AI and everyone capacity, the one that's a little bit more constructive, humanized, and that's what this is all about, you know, really promoting that, where people access their abilities and in turn are able to appreciate others. So this has been really great, Professor Waters, and you're going to be coming back for another episode later on, but I just wanted to, as it relates to any other insights that you'd like to share, there's so much here to tease out, which I will be, and I'll be following up with you, but as it relates to really harnessing their abilities and celebrating their abilities, are there any messages that you want to say in closing? I think you've provided us a lot today. And then there's a, you know, another piece in terms of resources or books or anything like that, which I could follow up with. So what's your charge, in addition to all the other charges you've given us, like indirectly?
I think the first is to recognize that everyone presents with something. Mm-hmm. And to start to have a little bit more extension of that grace that you talked about with other people. Because we always want it for ourselves, but we don't extend it as readily to others. So we have to flip that so that it's equal. and we are a very individualistic society, and that's how we kind of operate. But when you feel like you need grace, you want it to be given instantly and without any issue. But when someone else needs that extension of grace, a lot of people are less inclined to extend that. And we've seen that play out over and over and over. It's not until it affects you directly, in a lot of cases, that you don't care when it's happening to other people. But when it's happening to you, then it's a problem. And so that kind of empathetic response is not a weakness. It takes a lot of strength to extend yourself beyond your own body and into understanding and reaching out to someone else. It's actually the reverse. What we think is weakness in terms of showing concern for another person, it's been labeled as weak. But to try and grow your capacity for concern and care beyond your own body requires stretching. And if I was to do this with an AI, I have to have additional programming so that you're not just focused on this one person. You're going to focus on people in general, and they're going to have these different variables, and here's how you can navigate that. That's more programming than if I say, only follow Billy and do just what Billy does. That's a different value proposition altogether. So you have to start looking at it as a strength to have concern and to grow that capacity. We also have to look at there's statistical information out there where it's 1 billion people on the planet. I think this is as of 2020 from the reporting countries. So not all countries are reporting. Mm-hmm. 1 billion people on the planet have dyslexia. Mm-hmm. So I want that part to sink in.
Right.
If 1 billion people on this planet, that means 1 out of every 8 has this presentation, and that's just from the countries that report it, how likely is it that other people have other things, mm-hmm. like dysgraphia, dyscalculia, executive function, ADD, dyspraxia, all of these other things? And start to think about if there's 1 billion people with each one of those, what that means for our world. It means that most of us are processing things in a way that isn't, and quoting air quotes, textbook.
Yeah,
typical. It means that you still have to extend that expectation that you're going to be talking to someone that doesn't process in the same way that you do. Yeah,
that should be the default.
Right. So the default should be that you are going into any interaction with the expectation that the person you're speaking with or the room of people you're speaking to do not process everything in the same way that you do. Wow. And that's not a negative. It doesn't mean you have to speak in a different way. It just means you have to go in with the understanding that your way of processing isn't the only way, and that people who don't process the way you do aren't necessarily wrong or right. They are just processing the way that they do. And so we have to start to pull away because in computers and things like that, it's a 1 or 0, most people think. But we have conditional statements in computers where it's if, then, else. It's not just if, then. That else is important. So that means that if it's not one or the other, then you have to do a different thing. And that is really, really a critical piece of how these machines have been able to do what they do. A lot of people just give you if, then.
It's
one or the other.
Yep.
And there's no room for the shades in between. And so we have to actually think more like the computer's conditional statement. That's an example for us to ascribe to and subscribe to in terms of how we look at things. And then also looking at intelligence. Mm-hmm. We've decided that these machines are so much smarter than people, and we feel like it's inevitable that they're going to replace us. because we feel that they are so much smarter than we are. We didn't feel like that with the calculator. Like, no one thought a calculator was just going to sit up in front of a classroom and be the mathematician.
Yeah, that's it. Right, right.
But we have decided that AI is the one. It's going to
it's smarter
sit there
than us,
and it's going
right.
to perform everything because it's smarter than us. And it's really your calculator on steroids.
And I
so
love
you have
that.
To
I love that.
Decide what is intelligence. And I think I said this to you during the weekend. We have to start to bridge the gap between what you are experiencing as intelligence and what you mm-hmm. are assuming.
Assuming,
is intelligence.
Yeah, yeah. Because it extends beyond the brain as well. So there's so much there, right?
Right.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
just because you can't do a certain thing in the way the machine does, doesn't mean that it's intelligent. It has been programmed to perform a function. And so we don't ascribe intelligence to performing a function in that way in most other situations. So you can train and train and train and train your entire life to play jacks until you're a world champion player of jacks. But no one is looking at that performance and saying, oh my gosh, they're so intelligent. But you've gotten extremely good. You're world class. You could be on the world stage competing. No one says that about people in the Olympics even. They're spending their entire lives. They win a gold medal. No one inducts them into Mensa because they've gotten a gold medal.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So
we've
started taking the ability to perform a function very well and ascribed that as being an intelligence in these systems, but we don't do it in the any other
way. Yeah, not in other way.
And I'm like, why are we doing that? Like, my vacuum cleaner is wonderful at vacuuming, but I don't think of it as intelligent. Mm-hmm. But it's awesome at vacuuming. But with AI now, the minute you say it's AI, it's like, oh my gosh, if my vacuum cleaner has an AI, then
whoa.
That's it. There's no one else in the world is smarter about cleaning than this vacuum cleaner is now.
If anything, that we should
so
be looking at ourselves.
I want to talk through that too.
You know, I appreciate it. If anything, we should be looking at ourselves like that. Like, wow, look at how amazing and intricate the body is. We're just the most amazing beings. Like, you know, but we do it with AI. Oh, goodness.
We do. We do it with AI. Because part of it is fear.
Yeah.
Part of it is a lack of exposure to how these systems work. Part of it is marketing. There's a lot of marketing hype. In the course that I'm teaching this semester, we go over the Gartner hype cycle.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And we're going over it in particular with AI. And a lot of people have promised a lot of things about this technology. And they're over-promising because it's lucrative to attach those two letters to anything. The moment you say AI powered or the system has an AI, people are willing to pay more for it. And it's not always AI. You can have a machine learning statistical model that isn't necessarily an AI, and people will still call it an AI. You can have an API, which is a whole different thing, and people will still call it AI because its marketing value is so high that now people are not sure what AI is. And when people find out I'm an AI, they are telling me a whole lot of different things about what I do. So it's very interesting to me. It's like, oh, you know, you're an AI, so you don't have to do anything. Like, you just let the computers do everything. I've heard that more times.
Oh, yeah, 100%.
Than you
I've
can
heard,
imagine.
Yeah, heard that a lot as well. Oh, goodness.
And I'm like, oh, how did you come to this conclusion?
Yeah.
Because I'm curious now.
Oh, well, Professor Waters, this has just been a really great conversation. And I really do think, and I thank you. For joining us for the Universal Love Movement podcast, and it's this series on accessing ability. In essence, some of my like takeaways and summary really just lines what we're doing. We have to redefine how we perceive abilities. We're not trying to limit or label. It's about understanding, adapting, and most importantly, appreciating. And I appreciate you, and I thank you for helping us, you know, add to the growth narrative of the conversation with these pieces. And I just want to remind everyone else that, you know, this is a part three of a three-part kickoff series. And then episodes will be, you know, they'll be live on, you know, LinkedIn Audio at 7 a.m., but then they'll be available on all major podcasting platforms as we move forward. So final word, Professor Waters, before we close out here, final word, anything to say to the folks about yourself or anything like that before we close out?
Well, nothing about me. Just start to look up. I think that's important. We are enmeshed in technology, and we are paying more attention to the sky through technology than we are in reality. So it's okay to do some analog looking. So look up.
Look up. Oh, goodness, that's great. Well, thank you so much, and thank you for that were tuning in live. You could, once we post the link, as you all know, this is bonus with these podcasts, or usually just you access them, but we wanted to use this live feature. Thank you so much, Professor Waters. Thank you all, and this has been another episode of the Universal Love Movement Podcast. Have a wonderful day.